The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This is an article written by Rabbi Cook. We learned a little bit about Rabbi Cook. He was the first chief rabbi of Israel before it officially became the state of Israel. And his writings, I find to be incredibly essential, especially for our generation. As we mentioned, he lived from the years 1865 to 1935, which means exactly half of his life was in the 19th century, and the other half of his life was in the 20th century. And his life represents very much of who he is and how instrumental he is to Jewish education. Because he somewhat bridges the gap between those two centuries, and so much is happening during those two centuries, it's essential to understand how does Judaism relate, or what is the traditional message to the modern Jew. Alright? Therefore, I found in my own search that the writings of Rav Cook are incredibly important and extremely clarifying. Now, the article I'm going to share with you is an article going way back, somewhere in the early 1900s. And it's in Hebrew, as you can see. And I did not have the time to translate it all into English, but being that you've all had at least a couple days of Ulpan, I'm sure you could handle this. So we're going to do it in Hebrew, and I'll read it and translate and explain it. It's called Achdut Vishniut. Achdut, oneness, Vishniut, duality. Dualism. What Rav Cook is going to talk about is the relationship between spirituality and the physical. Okay? Because it's so essential to understand what is the relationship between the two. Are they opposites? Is there a dichotomy? Are they mutually exclusive? If they're not, what role do they play? What relationship do they have with each other? Do they enhance each other, or do they maybe diminish? You know, there's lots of questions that must be answered, and this is like a very basic understanding of Judaism, which is essential to really move forward. So it's not just really an idea in the dark that I happen to pull out, which happens to be nice, but this is really essential to understand the nature of Judaism in its most fundamental way, or its most essential way. So it goes like this. Haruchniyut, spirituality, milvad etneha hagdalim. Besides its great pleasures, le'ein tachlit, with no end, gishili atzma, when it is in and of itself, spirituality in and of itself provides tremendous pleasure, he tells us. Hu noten, he notenet oz vigdula gam l'chaim chomrim. Spirituality also gives power and grandeur also to the physical life. So he's established the principle that spirituality, although in and of itself, is of greatness and has and provides tremendous pleasure. The truth is that it also gives power, oz, interesting word, power and grandeur also to physical life, which is a new idea for a lot of people. Because most people see that there is a dichotomy between the spiritual and the physical. And a person who is somewhat spiritually oriented has somewhat of a distaste for, or a disliking for, or perhaps a disinterest for the physical. In fact, there's some people that when you speak to them, they feel that somehow the physical is going to interfere with their spiritual life. All right. In fact, there was a fellow who once applied to the program, and he made it very clear to me, in his most subtle, arrogant way, that he's a spiritual person. You know? A spiritual person. And, okay, fine. So then, we got to the point in the interview where I said, and in terms of the financing of it, right, you know, how can you deal with that? And he looked at me with, like, shock. Financing? You know, like, what do you mean by that? You know, I'm a spiritual person. And of course, it's a spiritual program. And I said, well, even spiritual programs have to pay their bills. You know, they have bills to pay. So is there, you know, how can you put forth your effort in helping us and helping yourself in terms of the physical needs of your stay here? And he said, money? I don't like money. I said, well, that's very nice, but some things cost money. And it was just amazing how he held of himself, so proud that he says, I've made it my business never to have more than $10 in my back pocket. And he made it into this whole ideal, whereby that how someone expresses that he's on some very high level, because he has such a disdain for and no need for the physical realm. Okay, and you can meet people like that, that somehow feel that to be spiritual means to somehow be anti-material. You got a point you want to make?
Very idealistic.
Oh, very idealistic, but very unrealistic. And in fact, the truth is, when you understand the true ideals of Judaism, you'll find that this is not at all idealistic. It is not at all idealistic to be spiritual and not material in Judaism. Rather, spirituality and its great pleasures that it gives in and of itself, and it can give great pleasure independent. You don't need the physical world to enjoy the spiritual necessarily. There is great pleasure in the spiritual world independent of the physical world. Okay? And yet, it gives power and grandeur to physical life. That too is quite a remarkable statement, a very new idea for a lot of people. Because a lot of people think that, gee, if a person is getting involved with the spiritual world, then they're going to lose their whole concern for, and their love for, or their commitment to, the physical realm. You know, it's like I've had this experience where, imagine if you were to say to one of your friends, well, I've decided to go learn about religion. And some of your friends might look at you like, oh no. Almost as if you just said a four-letter word that happened to be misspelled more than that. Like, what? You? No. And it's almost like, oh no, you mean you're going to leave us? You're going to leave this world of reality? It's like one woman in the course pointed out that when she told her friends that she was going to come to Israel to learn about Judaism, her friends started to almost console her and almost begin to eulogize her. And so many people said to her, well, I hope you won't lose your sense of humor. I mean, I hope you'll still be the same old. I mean, I hope you won't. And it's like this feeling like once you go into something like religion of some kind of spiritual interest, then you've left the real world and where everyone's at and what's really going on. All right? And so Rav Kook is making it very clear that it's quite the opposite. That when a person explores the spiritual realm, that spirituality gives vitality to the physical realm. And it does not detract from the physical realm. When a person really explores true spirituality, which we have to define, then they will find themselves even more physically oriented, which is a remarkable idea that he's about to clarify. However, what's happened in the past, in terms of the history of religions, so the idea of a religion is people leave this world, people go away. There were various, you know, cults and various little groups that would go hide in caves and would not have any water or bread, or they would fast for many, many days, or they would, you know, all kinds of things like that. You know, and that is what's being identified as being spiritual, whereby a person leaves and removes themselves and almost has a disdain for, okay? And a need to demonstrate their independence of the physical realm. Rav Kook is going to explain that the Jewish position is not like that at all. Okay? And you can see that in the most simplest sense, that that's the whole theme of mitzvot. The mitzvot keep you in this world. Because the mitzvot are so physically oriented. Okay? So physically oriented. Yes, there are books and there is, you know, Jewish meditation and there's prayer and there's singing. But predominantly the 613 mitzvot are predominantly very action-packed, physically oriented mitzvahs. You've got to take a lulav. You've got to take an etrog. You've got to build a sukkah. You've got to blow a shofar. You've got to eat a matzah. You've got to put on tefillin. You've got to light these candles. It all keeps you, in fact, in the physical realm. Okay? So, what's the relationship? There's a very deep relationship. The spiritual gives vitality to the physical. Now he says something really fascinating. As if that wasn't so fascinating till now. And when you see, and when you see an arousal, a desire, amongst the nation, the Jewish people, a desire to establish the physical life, what happens if you all of a sudden see within the people, within the nation, a new drive towards creating nationhood, towards building a country, towards planting trees, towards building and, you know, developing the physical dimension of the Jewish people, okay, or of themselves, all right? So then what is that? Siman hu, this is a sign, shaharuchniyut hamitgaberet la'olam, that the spirituality in the world has increased. Do you follow this? If all of a sudden you see people with this new interest and drive for establishing the physical life, what would most people say? Uh-oh, here we go. We're going into the material. We're leaving the physical interests of our nation. But Rav Kook explains, no, it's quite the opposite. When you see an arousal for establishing the physical realm, know that this is a sign that there has been an increase in the spirituality in the world, which has elevated also this physical, which is necessary in order to complete the plan of this formation. What's forming? The forming plan. In other words, when you see a baby being born, what's really being born into the world? Well, when you look at it, it looks like a body. And the child is only apparently aware of their physical reality. And not only that, but the baby is born in not the most beautiful of ways. You know, the baby comes out and there's blood all over the place and there's cock all over the baby, and this has been the birth of a physical reality. But in truth, what has really been born is a soul in the world. Okay? And what hides, what's the hidden agenda of this very physical manifestation? A very lofty spiritual plan. And even though our physical eyes only see something physical, the truth is that the physical is a manifestation of a spiritual process. All right? And so too, when we see within the nation a kind of birth of the physical reality and a real interest in the physical developing and perfecting and completing the physical, know that the truth is that what's driving this process along is a spiritual process. Now, of course, Rav Kook is also clearly relating to the early pioneers of Zionism. Because there were many, many that saw, like, here we go. You see these people, and all, they're interested in developing a land, but they don't study Torah, and all that. Some of them were very anti-Torah, and some of them were actively against, you know, actively trying to uproot Torah, you know? And so it's very hard for many, from the religious point of view, to understand what does this have to do with the spiritual process of the messianic vision of the Jewish people. Okay? Not to mention that b'chlal, the whole idea of having to go to the land of Israel is very, very difficult. You know, in other words, Judaism says that to go to the land of Israel is an elevation, it's an aliyah. But everybody knows that when you get here, you have to work harder, you don't have the same material, you know, the same material wealth, you don't have the same material comforts. And it's understandable that a religious Jew might say to himself, well, gee, I want to elevate myself spiritually. And what kind of elevation would that be to go to the land of Israel, whereby all of a sudden I come face to face with dealing with my physical needs? Out in the exile, I could learn more Torah. Right? And over there, I'm going to have to maybe tie down two jobs, and, you know, and, right? Well, that's the idea in Judaism. That in fact, part of the spiritual reality is the physical reality. Not that these are two separate realms, the spiritual and the physical, but rather the physical is an aspect of the spiritual. That's a basic point in Judaism, that the physical is an aspect of the spiritual. That's why he said that this is a tochnit hayitzirah. This is the plan of formation, all yitzirah, all of life, which is a forming. We see the development of the physical. Okay? We see the developing of the physical. But what's really going on is the spiritual. Okay? And the physical is an aspect of, a detail of, a spiritual process. Kishe aruchniyut mitgaberet. When spirituality increases, this is the second paragraph. Az motzim bnei ha'adam, then people find tam l'chayehem, real taste to their lives. Az hem mivinim, then they understand, umargishim, and they feel, shekedai l'chayot, it's worthwhile living, life is worth it. Okay? That's what spirituality does. Spirituality gives the physical realm taste. Because if there isn't a spiritual realm, if there isn't a dimension of divinity, a dimension of eternity, a transcendental realm that goes beyond the transient life that we're in, so then what gives the transient life any taste, any meaning? So really, when people think that there's some kind of dichotomy over here, more than that, there's some kind of mutual exclusiveness, it's either spiritual or physical, and you've got to choose which one. They're wrong in Judaism. That's not the Jewish path at all. Because Judaism claims that in fact, when a person increases their spiritual awareness, then that spiritual awareness gives their physical life even more taste, even more excitement. It's like I once mentioned, you know, generally people assume, and I once went to a kibbutz, and it was a question and answer with the rabbi. And I hate question and answer with the rabbi because you really can't answer one question without answering all the other questions. I mean, everything's so interconnected. How can you answer a question in Judaism when it's all so unifying? But anyways, that's what people want, so fine, had no choice. I got into the room, and it was a room of people I don't know. I said, okay, whatever question you'd like to ask, go ahead, I'm here. So there's a group of guys in the corner that crack up laughing. Right? They're cracking up laughing. One's going, you, come on, you, Joe. And go, no, I can't do it. No. Come on. And I'm seeing this whole thing, and everybody's like, what's going on? So I said, excuse me, do you mind if I ask your question for you? Right? Let me tell you what I think your question is. So they go, no. I said, yeah, let me ask you. Let me do it. Let me try, okay? It's like, okay. I said, is it possible maybe that the question you want to ask me is whether religious Jews have sex through a hole in a blanket? And they all crack up laughing. How did you know? I can't believe it. How did you know? As if it took so much. You see, that's the first thing people think about. When you say you're a religious Jew or you're an Orthodox rabbi, then the first thing they think about religious Jews is those holes in those sheets. What a boring sex life you all must have. But of course, I guess that's the price you pay for transcendence, right? I guess that's the price you pay for being such spiritual beings, right? Well, the truth is that that's ridiculous, okay? That was so rare. I mean, I'm not going to say that there weren't people who did that. But the question is, does that express the ideal of Judaism? In fact, there are many, many opinions that say that that is wrong. Not only is that not okay, but it's wrong, okay? It is wrong. And not like that, but it's really wrong to have relations with any clothing on. Okay? Because the man and woman should be completely unified. Okay? Now, if between them they decide they want to do this for whatever reason, that's their choice. But that someone should think, right? That someone should think that that's it. Judaism, because it's a spiritual path, is anti the physical pleasures of the world, okay? And only sees the physical pleasures of the world as somewhat interfering with, undermining the spiritual ideas of Judaism. They've lost touch with what Judaism is all about. I'm not saying that you don't find this in some other paths. Okay? Some other paths. I mean, I know, and I don't like to, you know, critique because it's not like I'm an expert on it, but I have read books whereby in Christianity, I believe it was Paul who said that better to be married than to burn. Which is, if you can't hold yourself back, you know, from your sexual drives, so at least get married and do it within the context of marriage. But, you know, what can we do? In other words, there's really a sense of dislike and a feeling of uncomfortability with sexuality. And yet Judaism says, no, the relationship between husband and wife is the highest form. It's so high, it's so much expressive of a spiritual reality that even the most beautiful time to do it would be Shabbat, Friday night Shabbat. Okay? Quite the opposite than the way other people, most people, thought Judaism is. In fact, there's a very famous story in the Gemara about a student of a rabbi who wanted to really learn about the sexual attitudes in Judaism. Right? So he decided that he would hide under the bed of his Rebbe. Alright? Because he figured, gee, you know, I'm too embarrassed to ask him, so I'll just simply hide underneath his bed. There's actually a Talmud like this. So he's hiding underneath his Rebbe's bed, waiting for his Rebbe to have relations with his wife. And, well, that's what happens. Rebbe has relations with his wife, and all of a sudden, Rebbe realizes that his student is underneath the bed. So he says, I believe his name, I think this, forget it. Whatever the name of the student was, he says, hey, what are you doing under there? Come on out. Okay? He says, what are you doing here? So he said, it's Torah and I need to learn it. Okay? It's Torah and I need to learn it. Do you think that you relate with your wife and the sexual dynamics is not Torah? It's part of Torah. And then he said to his Rebbe, he said, Rebbe, you know, I was really surprised. I just couldn't understand. I was, you know, he really had this understanding of something, I don't know, something very, whatever. I think you understand the point. The point is that he was shocked that a man of so much Torah would in any way express that kind of dynamic, that kind of pleasure, okay? And that there would be even a playful side to his Rebbe. Okay? Because nobody would think that these people who are spiritual or religious are playful. Because, you know, they're so serious and they're so meditative and they're so devoted to Hashem that, of course, that would interfere with and that would be actually almost, you know, almost a desecration to be playful and spontaneous and to really enjoy the beauty of the spiritual, of the physical realm. But once a person realizes that the physical realm is in fact part of the spiritual realm, a detail in the manifestation of the spiritual realm, then they understand that the two are not separate, not even mutually exclusive, but in fact, mutually inclusive. Okay? And therefore, when a person's spirituality increases, their drive for the physical actually increases. It's an amazing idea. Okay? An amazing idea. Things taste even more beautiful. Because when it was simply something part of a physical transient world, okay, you know, that's what it is. But now this eating of this apple is not just simply part of this world and because of my body and need a body, my body's hungry so I stuff this apple into my stomach, but rather eating this apple is connecting to the Creator and recognizing that the Creator has created this for me and all the various implications of that experience, and wow! That's not just an apple. That's unbelievable, right? That's something else. It gives you a whole higher experience of the physical reality. Now, who would have thought of that? But that's it. Spiritual heightens physical pleasure and does not diminish it. All right? And that's very important. Az hei mevinim, when a person taps into the spiritual, then they understand that life is worth it because if there isn't a spiritual realm, if there isn't an eternal realm, so what gives anything I'm doing meaning? What makes any moment in time have any value if it's just another moment, the midst of, you know, here today, gone tomorrow, and let's eat and be merry for tomorrow we shall die. What fun is that? Okay? And so, in fact, the Gemara in the Yerushalmi says, very beautiful thing, says that the physical pleasure, the sweetness of fruits, okay, the sweetness trains the tongue to taste Torah. That's what the sweetness of this world does. To taste the sweetness of this world gives your tongue the ability to appreciate, to tap into the sweetness of Torah, and the study of Torah. In fact, there is a Talmud that says that we have a responsibility to taste all the fruits of this world, those fruits that are permissible. All right, and if we don't taste the fruits of this world, and there are certain Rebbes that were very careful to find very exotic fruits and have them so they could taste them, then in the next world we will have to, so to speak, be liable and accountable for the fact that we did not complete ourselves. We did not train ourselves in all the taste that this world can help us taste in the next world. Okay? And the Talmud also says that everything in this world that is forbidden, its taste can be found in something that's permissible. So therefore there's no taste, no pleasure in this world that a person who is practicing Judaism and practicing and has centered their life on a spiritual path will be losing. In fact, not only will they not lose it, but they're obligated to find it and to taste it as part of their own spiritual development. Very important to understand this. And therefore he says, Erech HaChaim az holech ve'oleh, the value of life goes and increases. And therefore, people are seeking to establish their physical reality. Why? Why are people seeking to establish their physical reality? Because there's such an influx of spirituality, which the physical facilitates in this world. Okay? And therefore, it's just a natural thing. So when we see, so to speak, in America, there's this arousal of, you know, interest in health and people running and going to spas and, you know, eating healthy. So one can say, oh, look at that. There they go. They're losing it. Right? Instead of really thinking about their souls, they're thinking about their bodies. Okay? And they don't care about their souls. But the truth is, in a very subconscious way, what really ignited this interest in the physical realm, it's some deep subconscious connected to the influx of spirituality that's coming into the world. And somehow I don't even know it, but something hits me and I feel I gotta prepare myself. Because the physical is an aspect and it's the beginning of the birth of the spiritual. Okay? And so as the baby develops and develops and develops, what's really happening is the spirituality is becoming more able to penetrate and to become more manifest in even more concrete terms. Very powerful, very important to remember. And therefore he says, and therefore there'll be this search for establishing physical life, that they should be more secure, more broad, and more pleasant. All right? And I once mentioned to you the Talmud that says that a beautiful spouse and a beautiful house and beautiful furnishings widens a person's mind. Okay? Judaism is not against the aesthetics. God created the Garden of Eden, and not only was it functional, it wasn't simply vitamins on the trees, but it was fruits, and these fruits had a beautiful taste, and not only did these fruits have a beautiful taste, but they were aesthetically beautiful. And the aesthetics and the taste were precisely set up because all that inspires the human being, it prepares them, makes them receptive to the spiritual flow. So the Sephorno, the commentary, explains that the Garden of Eden was constructed in such a way that it would make the human being receptive to the spiritual flow in the world. It doesn't interfere with the spiritual flow. It doesn't have to. It could. Right? I'm not saying it can't, but it shouldn't. Okay? It shouldn't. And if it does, that doesn't mean you should go to the conclusion, come to the conclusion that shows you that materialism interferes with spirituality. It can. But the truth is that its ultimate is to facilitate the spiritual as the beginning of its very manifestation. Okay? And therefore, a friend of mine once asked his Rebbe, Rebbe, I don't understand it. Here I am living in America, and my ability to get a beautiful spouse, well, that I think I could get anywhere in the world, but a beautiful house and beautiful furnishings, I think my chances are much better living out here in the exile than going to the land of Israel with all the hardships of financing my life, right? Because it says a beautiful house, beautiful spouse, beautiful furnishings widens your mind. So his Rebbe explained to him, you don't understand, you don't understand. The Talmud says it widens your mind, but if you have nothing to fill it, that means you lead a very empty life. Okay? And so therefore, these become vessels to fill, to be filled by the spiritual. If they're not filled by the spiritual, they're empty vessels and they're meaningless. What does it have? I mean, I had the opportunity in my lovely travels and fundraising to be by some very, very wealthy people and to stay at some mansions of mansions. And yet, although the house is just absolutely incredible, there's no home here. You feel there's no home here. There's no life here. There's no relationship here. I'm not saying that it has to be that way. That's the point of this class. That you could have a mansion and that could widen your mind if you have something to fill it with. And it becomes a facilitator for even higher spirituality. As the Talmud says, a prophet had to be wise, rich, and strong. Wise, intellectually wise, was of great logic. In other words, the Talmud isn't saying to reach spirituality you have to let go of your logical mind or deny your logical mind, but actually he has to have the most developed logical mind to be able to be open to the prophetic mind. He has to be rich. Now there are those who say rich is in the figurative sense, who is the rich person, he who is happy with his portion. But there's some commentaries that said, no, literally he had to be physically, materially rich. Right? There are some kinds that he had to be materially rich. And he has to be strong. Now some say strength means, you know, in the figurative sense, mi agibor hakoveshet yitzro, who is truly strong, the one who captures their inclinations. But there's some commentators that say, no, also they have to be physically strong. Now this only complements the idea that it is the physical realm that is the beginning of the manifestation and facilitates the expression of the spiritual realm in the world. And when there's a great arousal increase of spirituality, then there's an increase in the physical and a desire for the physical. And those people might not even know why. But it's in order to facilitate the spiritual process. And therefore, what happens is people seek to establish themselves physically, but it's born out of an innate increase in spirituality, which they themselves are not aware of. And if they don't become aware of it, then their materialism will interfere with the process. But it doesn't necessarily have to. In fact, it's quite the opposite. And therefore, he says, "Az yirbu ma'olam shalom ahava v'rachva." And then in the world, there will be increased peace, love, and joy. Which just seems so strange. Because most people, right, blame the materialism for the non-peace and the wars and the strife. Okay? And, you know, if you remember John Lennon's song Imagine, then his whole vision of oneness and unity and peace is really very anti-materialism and anti-nationalism and all the things that Judaism is really all about. He was anti because he saw that as an interference, as an obstacle to the higher consciousness. Judaism says quite the opposite. Okay? It facilitates. Just like the body is not the opposite of the soul, but in fact the soul is brought into the world and is facilitated in this world by the body. And therefore, we love our bodies, and we do not seek to in any way damage our bodies. And so he says, "Az yimali schok pinul shonein arina." And then he quotes the verse, and then in that time, will our mouths be filled with laughter, and our tongues with joy. And very often people have this image of spirituality, and focusing and living a God-conscious life, as just very kind of morbid and sad and very serious. And you know, it was like when I was getting involved with Judaism, so I had this hippie cousin. I hardly ever saw my hippie cousin because she lived in the cellar of their home in some room, and I rarely would ever see her come out of her room. But one time I was visiting at my family's home or my aunt's home, and I heard this voice. I had just newly got involved in Judaism, and the family knew about it. And all of a sudden, I hear this voice from the depths, you know, calling me down. I said, wow, what an opportunity. What an honor. My cousin is calling me from her holy of holies to come meet with her. So I went down into the inner chambers. And in this, I mean, this is in the old days, of course, when you had like black lights and all these posters, and you know, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and there's some interesting fragrance that filled the room also. And my cousin says to me, she says, "David, I am so concerned about you." "Why?" "I hear you've become, I mean, it, don't tell me it's true. I mean, is it, have you become religious? You know? I said, "Well, I mean, I'm starting to practice some mitzvot." And I was like, oh no, the death of a cousin. You know, that was the end of it. And she said to me, "Well, how do you stand the silence?" I said, "I beg your pardon." She said, "How do you stand the silence?" I said, "What silence? I mean, with all that praying all day long." I said, "What are you talking about? I'm not praying all day long." And she had the craziest vision of what that meant to live a traditional life. But she's not the only one. Most people have the most strangest understanding of, my gosh, my kids in the yeshiva, who knows what. I mean, I know people who would tell me that they would get letters from their parents asking them, "Please find yourself a relationship. It's so important that you're expressing your sexual drives." Can you imagine your parents writing you these letters? I know people who told me, can you imagine, my parents are really concerned. Maybe something's wrong with me. Why am I in a yeshiva with all men? We're all women. And what am I doing in there in these dark rooms? You know, it's very bizarre. It's very bizarre. But it is the image that has evolved in the world. Okay? Because people think that the spiritual religious life is the antithesis of the material life. Alright. And it's quite the opposite. In that time, our mouths will be filled with joy. We'll be laughing so hard. I was at the home of a friend of mine one Friday night. And Rabbi Schuster, you know, picks up people at the wall and sends people for Shabbat. So he sent over some people from Hebrew University in Tel Aviv U. All right? And it was Friday night. We were at this friend's home. And, okay, we were all in a good mood. And I was cracking jokes, and my friend was cracking jokes. And it was just a lot of fun that Friday night. And we were laughing. But the whole time we're laughing, we could see that these university students were feeling very, very uncomfortable. You know, it was like they were looking at each other and kind of, what's going on? And then I cracked a joke, and everyone laughed. But there's one girl sitting there, and she's got this very serious face. And she finally says, okay, guys, cut it out. You're not really religious. This is not a religious zone. So we started laughing because we thought she was joking. And she was getting very angry and very frustrated by the whole thing. She says, you couldn't be religious Jews. You couldn't be Orthodox Jews. You have senses of humor. Right? And we started laughing. We thought she was joking. And she was dead serious. It was bothering. She just never believed that a person could practice Shabbat, you know, and lead a religious life and yet somehow be here and be real and be normal and, you know, as if that's somehow the antithesis of what it means to live this. But what can I say? This is one of the major breakdowns in the understanding of Judaism today. And one of the major obstacles for people really exploring it in the first place. We're in the third paragraph. Moving quickly, aren't we? Because the lofty and great spirituality, okay, he's implying that there is a small kind of spirituality. But the great spirituality, Hamakefet et hakol, it includes everything. V'choderet el tochakol, and it pierces to the very center of everything. Mimale benachle adnea, it fills with the streams of its pleasure. Gamet hachayim ha'rialim hachomrim, it fills the life of the real and the material. That's what the real spirituality does. Real spirituality, the great spirituality, which is what Judaism is really after. That includes, encompasses the physical realm, and it pierces its very core, it fills its very center, okay? And it fills all of realistic life. You don't become dreamy and weird and strange, you know? You don't become what people think, rather than becoming a BT, a Baal Tshuva, you become an ET, right? But rather, you are being more real. You're more in touch with yourself. And I would say that that's probably what bothered my friends the most when I became a religious Jew. What bothered them the most is they were hoping to see something crazy about me. They were hoping to see me maybe make blessings, you know, sit there going, Baruch! You know, they were hoping to see something really weird, and then that would confirm, ha ha ha, nut. Right? We knew he was crazy all along. That red hair, you know, we knew there's something wrong there. You know, but what they found is I was even more at peace with myself. I was more together. I still had my sense of humor, and I was still into the music that I was into. And yet, I felt I enhanced it all. I felt I put it into the very context that made it all worthwhile in the first place. But that bothered them. That really bothered them. Umitzarefet umizacheket otam. And the spiritual, the great spiritual, that encompasses the physical and fills the physical, purifies it. Because the great spirituality knows that the physical is not separate of the spiritual. Rather, achdut shleima yesh b'neihem. But there's a unity between the two of them. Ki shneihem mimikor echad motzim, because both the physical and the spiritual come from one source, God. And that is one of the most important ideas in Judaism. That when we say we believe in one God, that means that everything comes from one source, and therefore everything in some way is in fact unified, and organic, and interconnected. And when a person separates things and fragments things, then that is a denial of the oneness of God. And so when Jews make such a big deal out of the oneness of God, so you say, well, you know, what do you care, man? What's the difference? So there's 10 of them. Because it makes a whole difference in terms of your life. Because if there's one God, that means that everything in this world is an expression of unity, and is somehow unified. And therefore we say, God is holy, holy, holy. His glory fills the entire world. The glory of God is not only found in spiritual things, but in also physical things. And it's not either or. It's actually, it's found in both. In the uniting of the both. And that is essential for Judaism. Why? Because the verse says in Isaiah, Ki biyah Hashem tzur olamim. Because with the name Yud Hey, which is one of the names of God, God formed the worlds. So the oral tradition explains this for us. What are the worlds that God created with His name Yud Hey? The physical world and the spiritual world. This world and the next world. And God created the next world and the spiritual world with the Yud. And God created the physical world and this world with the He. And therefore, what does it take to really see the full name of God? You need to put the Yud and the He together. And this is essential in Judaism. This is essential in Judaism. That we are not trying to leave this physical world. We are trying to sanctify this physical world. Okay, we are not trying to leave the world of reality. We are trying to refine the world of reality. And the image of the Jewish experience is Jacob's ladder, where the feet are on the ground and the head is in the sky, and he successfully bridges the two worlds, the heavenly realm and the spirit and the physical realm. That is Yaakov. When Yaakov had his dream, it says, behold, he was a ladder. He didn't see a ladder, he experienced himself as a ladder that would basically span the physical and the spiritual and be that connecting point. That is our job. How do we unify God's name in the world? By demonstrating how much spirituality is in the physical and how much physical is expressive of the spiritual. And therefore we put on tefillin, and therefore we kosher, and therefore we do all these physical acts, which in fact bring these two worlds together, which is the true manifestation of the name of God. Okay? And so if a person fragments the spiritual from the physical, or the physical from the spiritual, that is a damage in God's very name. Very important to understand. V'ulam kitzrei asaga, but those who are weak, you know, short in their grasp, when they see a kind of inclination towards the physical, they get really excited and they jump on it. And in their fanaticism towards physicality, they seek to somehow nullify completely spirituality. All of a sudden, you know, there's a certain physical thing going on, a certain physical success. Nationhood is in the make. You know, economics are, you know, it's a good time for economics. And what happens? People jump on it. Okay? And in their fanaticism for the material establishment of their lives, they begin to try and destroy the spiritual. Why would they do that? Because they have such a narrow understanding of what spirituality really means. And in their narrow perception, they are afraid that the spiritual will undermine the physical. And I believe he's also alluding historically what happened. Because historically, when the pioneers started to this whole uprise, you know, of Zionism, there was this distaste for religion. But what fueled Zionism? It was religion. It was the Torah. And a lot of the early Zionist groups would in fact use verses from the Torah to call their name. What fueled their Zionism was the spiritual ideals of Judaism. And yet, somehow, when it started to take off, there was this process of disgust and anger and fear that the spiritual would undermine it. You know? Undermine it. And therefore, they sought to uproot it. And this unfortunately did happen historically. That when people came to Eretz Israel, there was, until today, there still is some of that, a real anti-religious spirit in Israel. You know, much more so than in America. You know, you can talk to Americans or Canadians or people outside of Israel about spirituality and about Torah. So much easier than to a lot of Israelis. There's this kind of, this negativity that's very deep. And you know where it comes from? It comes from understanding spirituality in a very narrow way. Which I'm not saying they're necessarily responsible for that. But there are those in the spiritual religious world that gave that understanding also. And just as much as those who were involved in the material saw the spiritual undermining it, there were those who were involved in the spiritual that were very frightened and very threatened by the material upswing that was going on in history. And so there's a struggle going on between these two parties. one pushing for the establishment of the material Israel, and one pushing for the establishment of the spiritual Israel, and they're fighting against each other, when in fact, what should they realize? What are you talking about? We need each other. What are you talking about? We're all involved in the same process. Okay, they mavirim, and these people who in their spiritual drives cut a line between the physical and the spiritual, make this line, boom, you know. And the worlds, the two worlds, the physical and the spiritual, that are truly one, it breaks into two that contradict each other. And that's what has happened to a lot of people. You know, it's a phenomena, but it's a mistake in the true understanding of Judaism. Okay. The Am Yisrael Goyachad Ba'aretz. But what is the character of the Jewish people? They are one nation. They are a nation, or it could be read as a nation of oneness. Goyachad. They are the nation of oneness. Their whole message to the world is the meaning of oneness. Their whole message is how oneness penetrates, encompasses and penetrates everything. Shashniyot snualo. And in the very spirit, in the very soul of the Jewish people, they have a natural hatred for dualism, for fragmentation, which is the source of their soul. Okay? And so, fragmentation between the spiritual and the physical happens. It doesn't simply philosophically bother Jews. It deeply pains them, without even knowing it. He's claiming that the spirit, the soul of the Jewish people, is very acute to, very aware of, the need for oneness. We are testimonies. We are witnesses to the oneness of God. And therefore, when that oneness of God is not being manifest, and how is it not being manifest? By the spiritual and the physical being separated and regarded as either or. That just bothers us so deeply. We're in such pain. Right? That happens even in terms of the whole relation between Judaism as a particular religion and yet the visions of universality. Jews are pained by not seeing unity in the world. Okay? Jews probably have the hardest time accepting that they're the chosen people. Because if that means somehow that the world is fragmented, and it's an either-or situation, then that really deeply pains the Jewish soul, or the national soul, which not everybody is tapped into. But the national soul naturally reacts strongly to the fragmentation and separation and dichotomy between the physical and the spiritual. And therefore what happens? Shehi Avodah Zarah. This dualism, this fragmentation, this breakdown into a realm of either-or and mutual exclusiveness is, in essence, idolatry. That's really what idolatry is. And the Jewish people's whole message to the world was against idolatry. Because what is really idolatry? People think idolatry is, you know, they took these stones and they bowed down to it. You know, much deeper than that. Idolatry is giving something independent value. That's idolatry. And nothing in this world of oneness has independent value. But the value of everything is derived from its relationship to everything. You follow? And when I take something and say, that's it, that's idolatry. And when I think that it has independence of everything else, that's idolatry. Alright? That's idolatry. And that's also fanaticism. Fanaticism is when, you know, when a person's committed to something, that's okay. That's commitment, and that's beautiful. But fanaticism, when a person's committed to a value, and seeing it having value independent of all other values. So in other words, if my value is establishing Eretz Yisrael, and I think that's more important than maintaining peace amongst the people, and it's so important that peace amongst the people is important at all, then I somehow see that these values are independent and are mutually exclusive. But they can't be, and they shouldn't be. And so therefore, the very soul of the Jewish people, in a subconscious way for many, and for many a conscious way, has a deep, pained reaction to fragmentation in the world. Because fragmentation is essentially the meaning of idolatry. Yes? Well, people can take the kotel and make it into an idol. right? And think that it has some kind of independent value. But when you really understand the way Jews relate to the Kodesh, you don't see that. You might see people kiss it, but nobody ever thinks that's God or that's this or that. But everybody sees it as a detail within the context of a greater picture. Yeah. That's actually one of the amazing things about Judaism. That we can take a detail and give it so much significance that people would think, my gosh, look what they're doing. And yet when you really go into our teachings, you really ask people to say, no. In fact, I remember one Friday night, I might have told you the story. I was there praying, and there was a Japanese man. He comes up, he starts praying too. Okay? Kind of sound like everybody else praying too. Because he's going, okay? And so he's standing there, but he was really intense. And it was really beautiful and very inspiring to me. You know? And I'm listening to this, and I don't understand what he's saying, because he's going on and on and on. But he's really fervent, it's just pouring out of it. He's going, he's going on and on and on. To that point, he falls to his knees, and he's going on and on. And then he's just so overwhelmed, he falls completely on the floor, right? Totally prostrates himself in front of the Kotel, with his head by the bottom of the Kotel, and his complete body stretched out, lying down, going, you know? And people are looking, and this is just not appropriate. We don't bow down to the wall, and we certainly don't prostrate ourselves to the wall. And this is really an expression, or this has a remnant. I mean, there's a certain element of idolatry going on over here. Too much. It just went over the line. So this cute little Hasidic man, he's looking at this Japanese man going, and he doesn't know what to do because this is inappropriate. So he comes up to him and he taps him very sweetly on the shoulder. And you can imagine this Japanese guy, he stops and looks at him, right? And this nice Yiddish man goes, excuse me. No, not here. No, we stand. God, stand. You know, and it was like, because there's a fine line, right? Because it's so fine, it's so easy to walk into the define and the confine and the separation of things. There is a fine line, there's no doubt about it. And there's sometimes people think, oh my gosh, they've made this into such an idol, it's become so independently valuable of everything else. But the value of Kotel is only because of how it participates in all of Jewish history and how it interfaces with the whole vision of the temple and the whole vision of Jewish people. But that would take much more to really explain. But it's important to understand that when there's a certain upswing of the material and people kind of with excitement jump, and what really made them excited about the material, it's some subconscious realization or sense that this is the beginning of a manifestation of something spiritual. But instead of really going with that and acknowledging that, they have this really narrow understanding of what spirituality is and what God consciousness is, okay? And then they somehow become so fanatically against the spiritual because it's so frightened it's going to undermine this advancement of material development. But the Jewish people, this pains them. And they're always seeking to bring unity. And that's why you're going to see such a separation in the nation. You'll see those materialists pushing against the spiritualists and those spiritualists pushing against the materialists. Why? Because the nation's soul is working itself out through these various factions to come to a balance and to come to a unity. Okay? Ein takana l'avodah zarah. There's no other way to fix idolatry. Elin titzav evud. The way idolatry is fixed is by destroying it. Okay? They have to smash the idols. V'yad poshe Yisrael babi rishona. And now Rav Kook says something which is in fact perhaps prophetic. And if he's saying this way in the early 1900s, the very early beginnings of the Zionistic movement, and people were very uncomfortable about it because these seemed to be secularists and materialists, and the religious were very frightened and felt very challenged and threatened that this would undermine the spiritual ideals of Judaism. But Rav Kook didn't see that. But Rav Kook says, listen, what's going to happen is these very people, the secularists, who with such commitment and fanaticism towards establishing the material, will be the first ones to destroy it. Okay? Now why? They'll be the first ones to destroy it. How does this perhaps relate to our times? Because we're finding that in fact, in many ways, that Zionist excitement is growing old and weary, right? And this drive and this commitment and this willingness to die for the land is being lost and lost. And now you're finding a whole new kind of Jewish society, Israeli society, that's very willing to give up parts of the land of Israel. And this is unusual. You know, and the nationalism, as well as you see so many Israelis leaving the country and losing the whole dream, and there's so many of the early kibbutznikim that are looking at their own children saying, what's going on with my kid? Why is my kid going leaving? And one of the ideals of a soldier in the army is when they get out, go to Sweden, go to India, you know. And it's a frightening thing to see how somehow that secularist movement is almost turning on itself and almost committing suicide. In fact, there are articles, there are actually editorials these days that are talking about this, the suicide of the nationalism in Israel. Okay? And so he might have had a kind of prophetic sense of how this whole thing's going to happen. What happens is, Poshei Yisrael sof sof gam heim b'nei amachan. Even those who transgress in Israel are part of the people of oneness. And therefore, in their insides, they know that the most important thing is oneness. And so when they go to an extreme that cuts off the material from the spiritual, without even understanding their own motivation, something just evolves within them, and they begin to turn on their own materialism. Initially, these people had destroyed the spirituality which they thought was undermining the physical. And now, what they're going to do is they're going to begin to destroy the material because in some conscious way they see it as destroying the spiritual. But of course, they're still making the mistake. Neither one is destroying the other, but rather must be unified. And he says, initially, they uprooted the spirituality with the kind of zeal which is very unique to the Jewish people. That the Jewish people, when they get into something, they have a certain drive and a zeal for it. And so with that same kind of zeal, spiritual zeal, they went out to destroy spirituality, right? To establish the material, and with that same zeal, he says, we're going to see them destroy the material and go towards the spiritual. Now to a certain extent, we see this somewhat in the Baal Tshuva movement. Then there's certain Baal Tshuva that go to the other extreme, you know, and have such a denial of their past life, and have such a denial of their physical needs, and have such a denial of who they really are, and what they can really handle. And it's very, very, very dangerous, okay, because the pendulum can swing right back. But all this was because they destroyed the idol spirituality. And what is the idol spirituality? It's spirituality which is independent and seen of having independent, separate value of the material world. And that's the spiritual idol. Alright? V'ulam mechoser havana, we're at the top of the next side of the page. V'ulam mechoser havchana muka hem toim lachshov, ki kvar akru et kol apniyot mishor shel. And from a lack of understanding and mistake, they think they've somehow uprooted the spiritual. Shemachshev ein od ruchniyah b'olam, because now there's no spirituality in our world. Aval b'emet, he spikul et tzatzrak et ilil, but in fact what they really did was they destroyed the idol spirituality. At the ruchniyat haluzianiyot, the illusionary spirituality, the romantic spirituality, the spirituality of a deceptive fantasy, but not true ruchniyat spirituality, which you cannot deny, which is always in existence, whether you acknowledge it or whether you deny it. That spirituality is the very soul of your materialism, the very context of your materialism, right? The very root of your materialism. Your materialism is only the beginning of the expression of facilitating an even greater spiritual current that is going to become more manifest and more manifest. And so in a funny way, they did a service to God by uprooting the idol of spirituality. What's the idol of spirituality? Because in the Israeli world, you know, in the secular Israeli world, their understanding is that a religious Jew is a Jew in Mea Shearim. Okay? And I'm not saying that that's not a religious Jew. But their understanding of Mea Shearim is these are people who are so divorced from real life, so much living in their fantasies, and the reason why they're in it is they could never really succeed in the physical world anyways, and therefore they need to run away from it. And religion is the opiate of the masses, those who cannot struggle and really accept the challenge of living in this world. That's their attitude, right? We understand that sometimes there are people like that. Okay? And that sometimes the spiritual ones have also fragmented and separated the physical from the spiritual. And see the physical as a threat, just much as those who are materialists see the spiritual as a threat. Okay? And so these two factions are fighting against each other. Both fanatical, neither realizing how much each need each other and complement each other. Alright? And so what happens in verse, the next paragraph, next page. V'acharei shegamlu et avodah netitza shel elil haruchniyot, heim al korcham baim lenetet gam elil haruchniyot. These very people undermined the spiritual world, they themselves will be the one to destroy the physical world. And since material is separated from the spiritual, they realize it has no value either. But that'll take some time, but all of a sudden it's going to hit them. And you should know that this is happening in the Israeli world, but you know what's happening right now at this stage? In frustration. We see a tremendous frustration in the people. You know, and you know where you see it foremost, I believe? In car accidents. Do you know that already, from the beginning of this year, right? From the beginning of this year, there have already been 400 dead from car accidents. Now, Rahmana Litzan, there have been 68 terrorists, people died by, killed by terrorist attacks since the Oslo, you know, connection, right? But the amazing thing is, 400 dead from car accidents in Israel. That's the highest reason for death in Israel. It's car accidents. It's absolutely frightening. Why are there so many car accidents? I think people are just so frustrated. So frustrated. Because they don't know, what's it all about? What am I doing here? Right? So why don't you just enjoy the physical world? But they can't. Right? There's an anxiety that becomes, which is taken out or expressed or released through acting in ways that are really irresponsible. Okay? And we see it in Israel, and it's very frightening, it's very sad. But this is the beginning of a spiritual awakening, a frustration with just simply living with the material and simply living with the national. And then what happens when this whole process hits the fan? Then all of a sudden you've got all these different factions, political factions. And all these arguing and fighting just take away the very joy of even the material. It's very hard for a person to be happy when in one hand they have their bread, and in the other hand they have their sword to fight off those who are trying to fight and take their bread. Okay? And this breakdown in the two worlds destroy, in fact, the two worlds. Tarti de Satre. People think that these are two opposites. Okay, the physical and the spiritual. This is Hu Maskanat Hegyonitzar. This is the conclusion of the narrow logic. Etzlo Hastira Mivia Lide Bitul Vekilayon. To him, the contradiction just brings to absolute destruction. Umivia Lide. I'm sorry. Aval Ba'olam Reali, but in the real world, this is not true. Rather, these two foundations that are opposite each other, the spiritual and the physical, actually unite and fertilize each other. The spiritual fertilizes the physical, and the physical fertilizes the spiritual, and there's a tremendous amount of fruitfulness through the connection, and a tremendous amount of death through the separation. And therefore, he gives an example that in the spiritual world, the angel for fire and the angel for snow work together, so to speak. Now, how do you put these two opposites together? So it can be done. However, in truth, from the perspective of great faith and broad faith, in other words, he's telling us that there is small faith and narrow faith, but the true Jewish faith, which is a broad faith, ein yachad la'gdiv la'fratet nishmat el menutena orgeh el ha'am. Such a person recognizes that the spiritual doesn't contradict the physical, and the physical doesn't contradict the spiritual, but in fact, together their unity brings a tremendous amount of fruitfulness. And then he quotes, I believe it's Zohar, that the divine presence does not dwell in a defective place. Therefore he's saying that a person who has a defective faith, which sees a dichotomy and a struggle and a conflict between the spiritual and the physical, will not be receptive to the true divine presence in the world. Omer HaZohar, the Zohar says, but this is not the portion of those who are the descendants of Jacob, who realize that everything's created by God. And if everything's created by God, there must be a unity. And our job is to see that unity, reveal that unity. Everything is one, He is one, His name is one, and everything in His hand becomes one. Even the spirit, the physical that is connected to the spiritual becomes refined. And its primitiveness and its animalism takes on a whole new refined image. Now, this is his final point. Sometimes we do see amongst spiritual masters, the righteous of the generation, that they do incline towards nizirut. Nizirut is to separate oneself, uprishut, and they hate physicality. So this is a beautiful philosophy. But Rav Kook tells you, I know you're going to see certain spiritual masters. You might even hear certain spiritual rebbes begin to tell you and really encourage you to remove yourself from the physical, right? And really have a disgust for the physical. Avozel simon sheba kilku be'olam. But this is a sign that the world is falling apart. When tzaddikim, great righteous people, have a disgust for the physical and have an inclination towards removing themselves from the physical. But this is, Zusimen Sheba Kilku Ba'alam, this is a sign that there is such a destruction in the world that in order to heal the world from this damage, they have to use some very strong medication. In other words, yes, there will be teachers and there will be spiritual masters who really put down the physical and promote removing oneself from those physical pleasures. But all this is not an expression of the ideals of Judaism. Okay? But rather, this is an antidote to a broken situation, a damaged situation whereby people become so physical and so material that in order to balance them out, we have to put down the physical. But that's a very strong, strong drug, shehivri kimuvan eino tzarich lamklal, that a healthy person doesn't need. A healthy person doesn't need to have these kind of one-sided presentations of Judaism. Okay? A healthy person deserves to have the balanced perspective in Judaism that sees the beauty, and not only the beauty, but the critical need for the unification of the physical world and the spiritual world. But granted, there's some people that are so into their physical world that the only way to bring them out of it is to really put it down and, but not that that's what I really believe in, but since you're so fanatic and you're so this way, I have to put that down to balance you out. But when I finally balance you out, I'll bring it right back and say, but you know what? Now that you've given up your house, now that you've given up all that fancy luxury, now that you're really able to live a spiritual life, now you're ready for an even higher spiritual life, which includes it, and which becomes enhanced by your physical. That's why it says in Pirkei Avot that the way of Torah is to sleep on the ground, to eat, dry bread, to drink water. So Rav Kook explains, this doesn't express the ideals of Judaism, but the way of Torah, which is a healing process, which is a therapy for a world that is broken and for a world that has unfortunately fallen into such material drives. So the way to do that is a person has to be able to let go of the physical world so that when they finally let go of it, they'll be ready to truly receive it in the balanced way it should be received as part of the manifestation of the spiritual. Let me finish this point and then you can ask your question. Mashal natnu mikubalim. The Kabbalists give us a parable for this idea, from the holiness of Shabbat and from the holiness of Yom Kippur. And what do they teach us? That the holiness of Shabbat is greater than the holiness of Yom Kippur. And yet, ubechol zot mitzvah lachol. And even though the holiness of Shabbat is greater than the holiness of Yom Kippur, what in fact are we commanded to do on Shabbat? We are commanded to eat and to drink and to really take pleasure in our lives. And Shabbat is more consistent. That you're supposed to do every week. And that's really remarkable. One would think, what do Jews do on the holiest day? So people with their very unfortunate, narrow understanding of what a God-conscious life is, would think, oh, they probably pray all day, they fast all day, they who knows what they do, all kinds of physical afflictions to overcome their physical desires. And so yet, quite the opposite. You're supposed to eat and drink and wear beautiful clothing and have beautiful furnishings and have relations with your spouse. And really involve yourself in the physical. One would say, this is ridiculous. How could the most spiritual day of the week be experienced by being commanded to be so involved in the physical? Because that's the true teachings of Judaism. That in fact the spiritual and the physical are united. And that the physical in fact participates in an undercurrent of a very spiritual evolution. And the evolution of God consciousness, which includes these two realms that have been created by one God. And therefore, Shabbat is actually holier than Yom Kippur. Because on Shabbat we're supposed to enjoy the food, and the drink, and the company. And the opposite is so about Yom Kippur. Kedushato pchuta mekedushat Shabbat. The holiness of Yom Kippur is less than Shabbat. Vasur lechol bo. And on Yom Kippur, it's forbidden to eat. And it's forbidden to take pleasure. So we don't eat, we don't drink, we don't, you know, put oil on our skins. We don't put shoes on that are, you know, considered to be more comfortable. Why do we do that on Yom Kippur? Why, in fact, is Yom Kippur a day where we basically somewhat afflict ourselves, remove ourselves, deny ourselves the physical pleasures of life? Because Yom Kippur has come to atone and to fix sins. And therefore, as an atoning therapy, as a process of fixing, so yes, you must remove yourself from the material in order to give yourself an added booster shot of the spiritual, but not with any intention of ultimately denying the physical, but ultimately unifying the physical with the spiritual. And therefore Yom Kippur comes only once a year, and for a very specific, targeted purpose, to fix the breakdown. But not as an expression of the ideals of Judaism. Okay? V'alkein eino ba'alapam b'tkufa yedua. K'shehachataim mitmarkin. However, when the sins, the transgressions, have been purified, cleansed, then the spiritual and the physical will unite, and the whole world will be filled with joy and deep pleasure. Zman simchatenu. This will be the time of our rejoicing.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.